From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate National Poetry Month with two poets who evoke two different worlds in their work. First, we talk with Jane Shore about writing poems about growing up Jewish in the 50s and 60s. They describe a life and an era through details, bathing caps, bargain underwear departments, her parents' dress shop. Her new collection of poems, Music Minus One, was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Also, Sekou Sundiata reads Harlem and other poems collected on his new CD. His reading style is very musical, and he often reads with jazz accompaniment. Sundiata is one of today's most popular performance poets, and he co-founded a label specializing in spoken word poetry, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Two of the nation's largest cigarette makers are talking with plaintiffs about a sweeping settlement of tobacco liability lawsuits. The companies, Philip Morris and RJR Nabisco, have made no comment. Bloomberg's Carl Kilb reports.
The two biggest U.S. cigarette makers, Philip Morris and RJR Nabisco Holdings, are moving ahead with talks to settle health-related lawsuits. Bloomberg first reported on the efforts back in February, pointing out that a settlement could eliminate virtually all of the industry's liability for smoking in return for strict advertising guidelines and a payment that could total as high as $300 billion over 25 years. Analysts say that would amount to about a quarter of the industry's annual revenue and could be covered by price increases. Tobacco stocks are having a positive reaction to the reports of a possible settlement. I'm Carl Kilb.
Leaking dikes along the Red River has prompted emergency action in Fargo, North Dakota. Hundreds of volunteers worked overnight and into this morning to plug the leaks as the river continues rising. The Red River, which has become overwhelmed by the runoff from a record winter snowfall in the northern plains, is said to be rising about a quarter inch an hour. Flooding has forced the evacuation of many small cities and rural areas along the river and its tributaries. House Speaker Newt Gingrich is said to be nearing a decision on how to pay the $300,000 penalty he was assessed after admitting he broke House ethics rules. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Gingrich is said to be considering two ways of paying the money, from his own pocket or from contributions raised through a legal defense fund. The speaker's wife has reportedly insisted Gingrich pay the penalty out of contributions, but that action would likely come under fire from Democrats in Congress. Gingrich met with the House GOP conference this morning and told them he has not yet made a decision. In December, Gingrich admitted he failed to seek proper legal advice in using tax-exempt funds to pay for a partisan college course he taught, and that he misled congressional investigators. He agreed to pay the $300,000, part of the costs of the ethics investigation. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
A former death row inmate who once came within 3 days of execution was freed this morning in Houston, Texas, after almost 15 years in prison. Ricardo Adalpe Guerra then began processing by immigration officials for his return to Monterrey, Mexico. Prosecutors dropped their case against him yesterday in the 1982 shooting death of a Houston police officer. The dismissal came after a judge ruled that key witness testimony could not be used in a retrial. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 15.65 to 6,603.81. Trading is active, volume 204 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 2.27 to 1,210.61. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, first quarter earnings at Ford Motor Company more than doubled from 1996. The company says it earned $1.5 billion from January through March. Chairman and CEO Alex Trotman says the performance was due to a strong improvement in Ford's automotive operations and that the company is off to a solid start this year. The first quarter results are far stronger than what Wall Street had expected. The stock market is mixed at this hour. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are debating the outlook for interest rates after the Federal Reserve reported that industrial production was stronger than expected during March. At the same time, though, starts of new housing slid. Many of the day's earnings reports have surpassed expectations. First quarter profit at Ford more than doubled to $1.5 billion. Time Warner beat its profit forecast, as did Compaq Computer. Tobacco stocks are being boosted by news of talks between cigarette makers and industry opponents for a negotiated settlement to cover smoking-related health costs. In the NASDAQ market, shares in Clarify Inc. have plunged to a record low after the company warned of little or no revenue growth. I'm Doug Krisner.
Colgate-Palmolive reported today that worldwide first quarter earnings jumped by 18% to a record high. The maker of Palmolive soap, Ajax Cleaner, and Hill's Pet Foods also says sales rose from $2.05 billion to $2.14 billion in the first quarter. Compaq Computer says profits jumped 66% in the first quarter. It says its net income for the 3 months ending March 31st rose to $387 million, or $1.36 a share. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, sponsoring a compelling dialogue, Before I Die, Medical Care and Personal Choices, on many PBS stations next Tuesday.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is National Poetry Month, the perfect opportunity to bring you an interview with a poet whose work I've really been enjoying, Jane Shore. The poems in her latest book, Music Minus One, are very autobiographical, about growing up over a store in New Jersey in a Jewish family in the 50s and 60s, with subjects like vacations in the Catskills, looking at the bargain underwear in the 5 and 10, shaving your legs, and playing dead. Many of these poems are about the small details that form you. The book was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Jane Shore lives in Vermont and Washington, D.C., with her husband, the writer Howard Norman. Here's Jane Shore reading an excerpt of her poem, Heat Wave, Cold War.
I wheeled my baby sister to the park, the baseball diamond deserted, a dusty, wavering mirage. It was hot, so hot the Chamber of Commerce canceled the annual chicken barbecue, the coals already burning under the empty grills. My father closed up early. We lounged around all afternoon in our apartment over the store. My mother wore her sheerest bra and panties. My father stripped to his boxer shorts. He sat at the kitchen table in the path of the fan, like a game of solitaire, the ticket stubs, the week's receipts before him. I was cutting out a family of paper dolls, wool winter coats and hats, the daughter's organdy party dress. My elbow stuck to the vinyl tablecloth, my thighs to the vinyl cushions. I was wearing the thick cotton underpants I'd worn throughout my childhood, my chest bare in front of my father for the very last time. The Cold War was on TV. My scissors cut along the shoulders, hips, the perfect neutral bodies. The father didn't have my father's bald spot, nor the mother my mother's belly. Their modest children, a girl and a boy, had underwear painted onto their skin. I cut out their split-level house in the country, their collie, their crew-cut lawn. I cut out their flagstone patio, shady backyard. The kit even had a fallout shelter with walls of painted shelves filled with canned goods and bottled water. Too hot to talk, too hot to eat, we lowered the blinds and sat in the dark all day and evening. Turning on lamps only made more heat. We camped out on the living room sofa, Ozzie and Harriet, canned laughter, the news. The station signed off. Jets flew in formation to the strains of the national anthem. When the peacock's tail feathers fanned out, an array of grays, my father flicked the dial. We watched a white dot fade and shrink to nothing in the center of the blackened screen. Finally, we all tried to sleep. My mother lay down in the twin bed across from mine, on top of her separate sheet, dabbing her forehead with a cold washcloth. During the night, the fever broke. Only juice for breakfast. At 10 a.m., in shorts and a halter, I went downstairs with my father. He unlocked the store, 30 seconds to turn off the alarm. Inside smelled stuffy like a closet. He got the big ceiling fan going. Cooling air rustled through the dress racks. I had left my mother working at the kitchen table, pasting up the ad for Sunday's paper, snipping and gluing the cutout models on the page under Corduroy Village Summer Sale, 20% off. While my father dusted the counter, I modeled jewelry for no one. The first customer walked in about 11. Formal to the end, under his suit jacket, my father wore a short-sleeved shirt and kept his tie tied until closing.
Jane Shore, I think one of the things that I like so much about your poems is your sense of detail and the triggers that some of those details set off in me. I think some of your poems just set off these, like, sense memory reactions. And I'm wondering if you always gravitated toward the details of your memories and of day-to-day life.
When I was growing up, one of the things I loved to do was paint. I was very interested in the visual world, painting. And because my parents had a store and because there were clothes in the store, women's clothes, I was always very interested in the specific details of what I saw before me. But I think I always went for the visual rather than the oral. I always felt that I loved seeing things. I love seeing the things around me, and I love seeing stuff in the world, the things of the world, just walking around and looking around.
Let me read a couple of lines that are, again, kind of the details of life that, for me, evoke real sense memories. I snapped my rubber bathing cap under my chin, tucking in my ponytail, and inched down the ladder into the pool, aquamarine as the birthstone ring I'd left in our hotel room for safekeeping. I remember the bathing cap. I had the ponytail. I sometimes got into pools in the summer. I remember when every girl I knew had a birthstone ring, the amethyst or the turquoise, whatever the other stones
yes.
were. I guess these were the details of life. I always figured one had to leave to become a poet. You had to kind of give up this boring world of the rubber bathing cap and find a much more interesting world to write about if you were going to write poetry.
Yes, that's what my teachers told me that. They said that poems had to be about life, death, love, beauty, and nature. And that's what poems were about. And it struck me that in my life, filled with bathing caps and bras and...
right, which you also write about.
that it was certainly far from beauty and certainly not about life and death at all. So, but the older I get, I find the more I return to those things of, those specific things of childhood, those specific objects, which I just can't let them go. It's like going into an antique store and something calls you to
yes,
them.
Yes, exactly. That's funny because I think you just described exactly the feeling I have from some of your poems. Did you ever try to write poems with more exalted subject matter?
Well, I hope that even though the poems... You mean sitting down to be profound.
Exactly. Like reaching for those big subjects, the life, the death. I mean, your poems are about life and death, but actually literally writing about them in a more literal way.
When I was 14 and 15, I wrote a lot of poems about life. And I wrote poems about the womb of oblivion. That was my big
line.
Or the kaleidoscope of life. And it turns out that that's what my students write about, too, mm-hmm. although they're not 14 and 15. They're a little bit older than that. But I think that's where everybody starts. And I actually think I set out to write poems that I felt were about profound subjects so I could baffle my parents so that they wouldn't understand what it was I was writing about. And I think that I just... I'm not that kind of poet. I really feel I don't get the kind of pleasure. I don't know. I think when I was starting to write and as I began writing more, I guess I didn't feel like I had any really big ideas. And that if you were going to write about the smaller things or the things that appeared to be uninteresting except to yourself, that if the poem was really going to work the way it should work, it would somehow touch on the larger things. But if I sit down and say, now I'm going to write a poem about life, I just can't do it. But if I say, now I'm going to write a poem about a Mahjong bracelet I have or a Mahjong set I have, very quickly I can find, once I start exploring what that object is or that game is, I can start finding deeper things, although I don't consciously know it when I sit down to write it.
My guest is Jane Shore, and her latest book of poems is called Music Minus One. There's another poem I'd like you to read from the book, and it's the poem called Workout. Before you read it, would you tell us what inspired the poem?
I have a sister who's 8 years younger than I am, and she, I think, had to really follow in my footsteps in a lot of ways. And it's about, I guess it's my sibling rivalry poem. It's about growing older and feeling that who has the advantage, perhaps, feeling the kind of burden of being the older sister. Also, I know there's a burden of being a younger sister. And also, everyone says that the older sister is the one who's the nice, well-behaved girl, and the younger sister is the one who's the rebel. And so I guess both sisters have their burdens to carry. But my sister is a folk singer also, and she sings country and western and folk. And I think she inherited the musical talent in my family. And this is a poem about that, about feeling that one passes through stages of life. It's about rivalry. It's about wanting to not have a sister, I think, at times. Although now I'm very happy I have a sister. Workout. My sister is doing her exercises, working out in my husband's study. The rowing machine sighs deeply with every stroke. It's heavy breathing, like a couple making love. She's visiting from Iowa, where the cold weather is much worse. When she was 10, I'd hear her strumming her guitar through the bedroom wall. She'd borrow my albums, my Joan Baez, my Dylan, and sing along, shutting me out, drawing me in, imitating my hair, my clothes, my generation. I used to feel sorry for her for being 8 years younger. She opens the door a crack and surfaces in earphones and wearing pink bikini panties and a lover's torn T-shirt. Strapped to her hands are the weights that weighed her suitcase down. Her thighs are tight, her triceps shine, her body is her trophy. The night she arrived, we sprawled across my bed, her cosmetic bag spilled open, and she shadowed my eyelids violet, demonstrating the latest tricks, the way I used to make her up on those nights she watched me dress for dates, watched me slip into my miniskirt, my sandals, my love beads. Now she's no longer in love with me and eyes me pityingly, triumphant, her expression the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. She's got to keep in shape. She's a performer. It's her business to look beautiful every night. Sometimes, when she begins to sing, men in the audience fall in love. She's warming up in the shower. The tile walls amplify her voice, safe for once under temperate rain. Like a dress handed down from sister to sister, in time, one body will inherit what the other has outgrown.
Has your sister read the poem?
Yes, in fact, she said when she read it, she said, well, it's the one poem that you wrote about me, and I don't love it, but, you know, it's the way you really felt. Yes, it is. Now that I read it, I realize, well, I guess I knew it when I was writing it, too. I'm 8 years older. I'm a lot of pounds heavier. It's about rivalry.
There's the line in the poem when you say that your sister's expression was the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. What did you think about when you watched your mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror?
You don't want to think that you're actually going to be like that once yourself. And in fact, I'm working on a poem right now in which I've inherited my mother's magnifying mirror. And I don't like what I see. I mean, what I see is my mother's face. You look at yourself getting older, and you think when you're a younger person, that'll never happen to me. And when I'm that age, I'm going to be really beautiful because I'm really going to take care of myself.
No, when I'm that age, I'm going to be really young.
That's right. I'm still going to look just the way I look when I'm 20. But in fact, it's absolutely true that you look at yourself and it magnifies who you are. It magnifies your faults and maybe your good things, too. But unfortunately, I look just like my mother now. And my sister knows that. So
So she scores a point for that?
Well, you know, I realized also, I mean, at the end of the poem, it's a kind of curse. You know, one day you're going to get what I don't, you know, what I have now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a kind of curse. I guess that was my last, I had to get one last lick in. My sister was not thrilled with this poem.
My guest is poet Jane Shore. Her latest book is called Music Minus One. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Jane Shore. Now, you were recently nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for writing.
Yes.
But you didn't win.
No. But, you know, being nominated, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it's really true. It is almost as good as winning.
Did you feel really bad when you lost?
Well, I lost to the Poet Laureate of the United States.
Oh, and he's a wonderful poet.
And he's a wonderful poet.
Yeah, he's great.
And I've read his work forever, and I've learned so much from reading it that I really didn't feel bad at all.
And is the nomination helping you in any measurable way?
It's certainly, you know, some people, when they have good news or good luck, they get very depressed and they go into bed, like my husband. If something really good happens to him, he'll immediately go to sleep and pull the covers over his head. But I just respond by getting just more enthusiastic about what I'm doing. I really do. The minute my book, the day after the first publication of this book, I sat down and just started writing like a maniac. I just respond very, very well to encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do. I life's too short.
Title poem from your book, Music Minus One, is about your father.
Yes.
Who used to play with big bands, I guess, in the 30s and 40s. Played with Clyde McCoy. Did Clyde McCoy have the recording of Sugar Blues?
Yes, and this is an amazing thing that just happened. I was in San Francisco last week, and I was in a bookstore. And I was leaving the bookstore, and on the way out, I walked by the music aisle. And a title caught my eye, and it was the Big Band's Almanac. And I thought, well, hey, let me just take a look at this and see what's in there. So I looked up M, and I looked up Clyde McCoy, and there, the picture of Clyde McCoy's band was a picture of my father, taken in 1936, I think, when he must have been 21 years old, and there he is playing. And I almost died. It's the first time that my inside, what I felt was my personal inside history, suddenly was, there I was in the bookstore, and there was a picture of my father.
Now, your father had to give up music, I guess, to be home with the family, maybe, or?
Well, it was after, he had played before the war, then he'd been a Marine in the war, and he'd led the Marine band. He played in the South Pacific, and when he came home, it was another world. He married my mother, and I was born a year later, and I think he felt that music was no life for, if you wanted to be a family man, you couldn't stay out all night playing music. You couldn't lead your wild, crazy life that you'd lived before. And he right away went to work in a music repair shop on the Lower East Side. He did that for a year or two. And then I think he was just really looking around to see what he could do. And my mother had been a saleswoman, I think at Bambergers or Stearns in Newark, selling cosmetics. And they decided to go into business. And in the beginning, he was just going to help her. And then as the years progressed, he got more and more involved in the business.
I'm wondering if when you started writing, you thought, well, I'm going to stick with it. My father had to give up playing professionally and ended up owning a store, but I'm going to stick with this writing thing.
I think that was the center of what... I always felt the sadness that my father had. And even though I would say, Dad, you know, wouldn't you rather be playing now? Wouldn't you rather be in the band? Wouldn't you rather be on television with all your buddies that you see on Johnny Carson? And he'd say, no, I'm quite content. I can listen to my music. And because he had a tremendous collection of records. He'd listen to the radio day and night. But I never really believed him. Never. I thought, well, why would you want to give up that glamorous life for this? But in fact, I think that you're right. I think that if you have a commitment to something that you really, really love, and if it's possible to do it, and I think you make it possible to do, then you should do it. And with my father, I think there were circumstances. He was born, it was the Depression. People had a different mentality. They gave up a lot of things that I think I certainly nowadays probably would not give up.
I have one more question for you. You said before that you respond really well to encouragement. As a teacher, how do you handle encouragement and criticism?
I immediately, because I had wonderful teachers in college and graduate school, I think that a person does not do well when they're yelled at or when they're made fools of. I feel that if you write a poem and there's one terrific line in it or one image in it, you should know that you did that. And I believe that poetry and all art grows through nurture. And I try to treat my students the same way that my teachers treated me, which was really encouraging, really. But when you do something that's not so good, when you write a cliche, you have to be told also so that you won't keep making the same mistake. And also with my students, everybody has a very unique life. Each person has a unique life, and only they know what they can write about. And that's the thing I try to get to them. I think if you try to write about everything that you see around you that's not you, you won't get art, you won't get a good poem. But the more particular you get, the more specific you get in your life and in your art, I think that's when the really good work happens.
Well, Jane Shore, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Jane Shore's latest book of poems is called Music Minus One. Here's a recording featuring the band her father played with, the Clyde McCoy Orchestra. This is Sugar Blues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Coming up, Harlem, Shout Out, and Blink Your Eyes. Performance poet Sekou Sindiata reads his work. He's not only one of the most popular performance poets today, he co-founded a record label devoted to spoken word. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're celebrating National Poetry Month. It's easy to listen to Sekou Sindiata's poems, like Good Songs, over and over again because you like the music. Sindiata is one of the performance poets who has attracted a following among many young people who like the rhymes and rhythms of rap. Sindiata often reads with a band behind him and has created several music theater works. He co-founded a record label devoted to spoken word. That label, Mouth Almighty, has just released his first CD. It's called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. We'll hear an excerpt of it later. We invited Sekou Sindiata to read and talk about his work. Here he is reading his poem about how his old neighborhood has changed. The poem is called Harlem, A Letter Home.
It hurts me to my heart to see you like this, underworld and underweight, impossible to be with, impossible to leave. I must approach you the way I approach music sometimes, late at night and by myself, when people who can't understand are long gone, like the famous who want your infamy without your tragedy, like the rich who want your treasure without your pain. Too hard to catch up and too hard to follow, I keep looking for you anyway. Over by Harlem River Drive, where years ago you went underground, leaving two dead policemen in your trail. Then backstage at the old Apollo Theater, where we used to be waiting, pulling on the stars, begging them to kiss us like they sing. I walk around with this photograph of you at the African American Day Parade, looking like a 33rd degree Mason, an old African, a Parliament Funkadelic, an Eastern Star, a grand and flowing feather, and a Marcus Garvey hat. But in your ashy, sunken face, I see a falling of flesh from bone. I see your red eyes, your blue hands, your protruding ribs, where once I entered and lived. You were my living room, my address, and my home. What remains the same is how little, how much you've changed. You don't belong to Bird or Billy anymore. You don't belong to Malcolm or Langston anymore. And no point telling me whether you left them or they left you, since the whole thing was out of your hands. Since you have no more control over death than you do over life, but you make it and you shape it and you make it and you shape it every day. Maybe that's why you never sleep. Maybe that's why the rings around your eyes are thin lines between love and hate, that you can enter and leave at any point, the definition of a circle. Which brings you right back to where Bird plays and Billy sings, to Malcolm and Langston's words, the songs, the speeches, the poems, more alive now than them. But you're coming back is your power and your redemption. Oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem. I have searched every place, every body, every name I have ever been for you. If not your beauty, then your ugliness. If not your rhythm, then your story. Oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, oh, Harlem, it hurts me to my heart to see you like this.
That was Seiko Sundiata reading Harlem, A Letter Home. Thanks for reading that. And I should mention that you also read that on your new CD, Seiko Sundiata, The Blue Oneness of Dreams. You're a poet who uses your voice in, I think, a particularly musical way. And I wonder if you were always reading that way or if you had to find your voice.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the way I present my work has evolved over time. You know, and I've thought about it. You know, in the beginning, it wasn't very conscious, really a very conscious development. But as I thought about it over time, I really set about trying to develop a sound and approach that I thought was uniquely mine. I should also say that, you know, in the way that I started writing poetry and got into poetry, I really felt that I was trying to ground myself, first and foremost, in African-American culture. And so my first love in African-American culture was black speech and black music. And really, I think to understand something about black speech and black music, you know, helps anyone understand what's going on in black literature, whether it's fiction, poetry, playwriting, whatever. So for me, it has always been a question of the musicality of language, the musicality of black speech. So by the time I started writing and reading my poetry, I was really started being interested in developing a sound that was mine, much in the way that, you know, jazz musicians. Music to me has always been a reference point and a resource, you know. In jazz, you know, certain things are given. By the time a musician gets on the bandstand, technique is a given, harmony is a given, that you've mastered your instrument is all given. You know, the thing that has to be revealed yet is how you sound, which is to say, what do you have to say? What is your particular take on your instrument and your take on the world? So that you may have two tenor saxophone players, both playing body and soul, for example, but each of them having something fresh and different to say. And, you know, I kind of use that as a model as I, over time, have developed my way of reading and presenting my poetry.
Now, when you realized, like, the musicality of speech, you could have gone into acting or even singing, but you wrote. What led you to writing?
Well, you know, I guess once I was in school, I really just, I love to write. You know, I love to read and I love to write and I like books. And I loved music, but, and, you know, I tried singing as well, but
did you?
Nothing called me, nothing appealed to my imagination as much as writing. I mean, even before I started writing poetry, those times when I was, you know, reading or writing, you know, I discovered that this was a pathway to, you know, a source of great joy for me, a source of great pleasure, which was to be in my imagination, you know, where, you know, where there are no boundaries, where I can imagine anything, that seemed more possible to me as a writer than, you know, let's say, as a musician or as a singer or even an actor.
My guest is poet Seiko Sundiata. He has a new CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Seiko Sundiata. He has a new CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. What were you writing about when you first started to write?
I was making stuff up.
They call it fiction.
Yeah, yeah, right. you know, I recall when I was in school, I would sometimes have to write a book report. Sometimes I would do the book report and do this alternative book report. Let's call it that as well. Sometimes I would just do my alternative book report, which is I would make up a book and I'd make up a title and, you know, and I'd report on it. And I'd look in the phone book and try and find a name for an author, just a name that sounded right.
Now, your teacher may have called that cheating.
Exactly.
So what kind of books would you make up?
You know, I liked adventure stuff then, you know. I'd make up books about war or about, you know, the frontier or, you know, things like that. And it's interesting, you know, the stuff that I made up was very close to the stuff I was reading, resembled very much the stuff I was reading in school. So I didn't write about my neighborhood and my community yet because I didn't realize that my neighborhood and my community and my life was something you could write about.
How did you realize that it was?
I think towards, going into the 1970s, towards the end of the 60s, I started hearing poetry by poets who were, you know, already developing at that point, who were writing these poems using, first of all, the kind of vernacular culture and speech that I heard in the community, you know, and wrote about subjects and themes that I felt very close to, that I felt connected to. I think of a poet, Victor Hernandez Cruz, for example, Puerto Rican poet, you know, who wrote about Puerto Ricans in New York, who wrote about, you know, the projects, who wrote about the Lower East Side, which was so, you know, so familiar to me. Or Miri Baraka, you know, who wrote about black music. You know, when I started hearing, you know, music figures showing up in his poetry, like James Brown or John Coltrane, you know, it gave me a whole other look at what was going on around me, what was going on in the culture, and it elevated, in my own eyes, my own culture. So I really feel, you know, in a lot of ways, that poetry and that literature saved my life.
Saved it from what?
Well, you know, I mean, I could have gone in any number of different directions, you know. I tried to be, I tried to be in the streets for a while, you know. I tried to be the tough guy. I tried to do a lot of that stuff, you know. It wasn't me. You know, it just wasn't my life. But I had nothing else going on instead of that. You know, I went to school, and I did fairly well in school, and I was sort of interested. I played sports, particularly basketball, and, you know, I was interested in that, and I played okay. But there was nothing really at that point really pulling me and engaging me in such a way that, you know, made me want to say, hey, I really want to do this, you know, until I started hearing that poetry and started experimenting with it. And it became a real possibility. And the other part of it is that it gave me a way to connect up to my culture and to black life in a way that I thought was vital, in a way that I thought was really socially engaged, particularly at that time. And that was very important to me, you know, to have some involvement in the struggles and the life and, you know, the mythology of my community and my people.
Since you had tried to be the tough guy but didn't think you were very convincing at that, when you got more interested in writing and particularly in poetry, did you feel you had to, you know, masculinize it in any way? Did it feel like it wasn't either hip enough or masculine enough for you?
See, you know, I mean, the fortunate thing for me is that at that time, something close to what's going on now was happening. You know, right now we're in this sort of revival or of poetry and spoken word. And at that time, it was very popular.
Oh, it's, you know, like the Last Poets and Baraka.
Right. So you could say you were a poet and be hip.
Right. Mean, revolutionary.
Right. You know. And I was very much involved in the movement at that time. You know, I was an activist. I was a radical. So, you know, all of these things fit, you know. And it made me, you know, it was a way to be cultured and civilized, which is to say a way to be hip.
Were you writing revolutionary poems?
Yeah, I wrote revolutionary poems. I wrote militant poems. I wrote most of my poems in those days were you know, about social issues in the main, you know. And I always had a couple of love poems going. I guess part of that is the inspiration of popular music, you know. I always thought that one of the great songwriters to me whose work was just so poetic was Smokey Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Smokey Robinson, I think, wrote great lyrics, great love lyrics.
I think this would be a good time to hear another one of your poems. I'm going to ask you to do another poem that you also do on your new CD, and the poem is Shout Out. So before you do the poem for us, maybe tell us a little bit about writing it and about, a particularly musical kind of poem.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if I had to describe, you know, a qualifying thing for me as a poet, you know, people say, well, you're a performance poet or whatever. That's not really how I identify myself. I think of myself, if anything, as a ritual poet, meaning that I think of poetry as ritual. I think that is the roots of it, you know, the roots of it in chanting and dance, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really thinking about trying to create a poem that would have a ritual feel to it in the sense of being an opening, an introduction to what is to follow, whether it's, you know, more poems or the set with the band. This is typically how I open a set when I perform with my band, the body of the poem. I'll just also say that, you know, shout out is a tradition on radio, particularly on black radio, where basically people call up the radio station and give shout outs. You know, they a shout out to, you know, my cousin, a shout out to my girlfriend, a shout out to whoever, you know, and it really is just a dedication. I always loved that because it was just a chance for, you know, everyday folk to get access to this mass media, to the airwaves, and make a dedication. So here it is, shout out. Here's to the best words in the right place at the perfect time. Here's to three-hour dinners and long conversations, to the philosophical ramifications of a beautiful day. To the 12 steppers at the 13th step, may they never forget the first step. To the increase, to the decrease, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the done, done. To the lonely, to the brokenhearted, to the new blue haiku. Here's to all or nothing at all. Here's to the sick and the shut in. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the crazy, the lazy, the bored, the ignored, the beginners, the sinners, the losers, the winners, to the smooth and the cool, and even to the fools. Here's to your ex-best friend, to the rule benders and the repeat offenders, to the lovers and the troublers, the engaging, the enraging, to the healers and the feelers and the fixers and the tricksters, to a star falling through a dream, to a dream when you know what it means, to the bottom, to the root, to the bass, boom, to the drum. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to somebody within the sound of your voice this morning. Here's to somebody who can't be within the sound of your voice tonight. To a low cholesterol pig sandwich smothered in cyan without the pork. To a light buzz in your head and a soundtrack in your mind going on and on and on and on like a good time. Here's to promises that break by themselves. Here's to the breaks with great promise. Here's to people who don't wait in the car when you tell them to wait in the car. Here's to what you forgot and who you forgot. Here's to the unforgettable. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the hip-hoppers, the don't-stoppers, heads nodding in the digital glow of their beloved studios. To the incredible, indelible impressions made by the gazes you gaze in the faces of strangers. To yourself you ask, could this be God straight up, or is it a mask? Here's to the tribe of the hyper-cyber, tripping at the virtual-most outpost, at the edge, on the tip, believing that what they hear is the mothership. Drawing near. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found.
I love hearing you read that. What are some of the more unusual places you've read that in?
Unusual places. Well, you know, I always, every I perform in Europe, you know, frequently. And that's always an unusual place to me to be reading because I, you know, I only speak English, you know. So, I mean, that's, you know, to read that in situations where the audience, most of the audience, you know, is not understanding it in the language in which it's written is quite unusual to me.
But they could still get it sonically.
Yeah, I think that's what happens, yeah. Which is, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about, you know, I really think that poetry, you know, I have a colleague, Pablo Medina, who's a wonderful poet and fiction writer, who says that, you know, poetry communicates before meaning even, you know, and I really believe that, that there is something before the actual content, the meaning and the content of the words that is communicated by poetry that I think allows it to sometimes cross those language barriers.
My guest is poet Sekou Sindiata. He has a new CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with poet Sekou Sundiata. He has a new CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. You have music behind you on a lot of the tracks on your new CD. Do you work on the music yourself? Do you interact with the arranger for it?
Oh, yeah, no question. And, you know, the co-producer on this CD is a longtime friend and collaborator by the name of Douglas Booth. And he and I wrote some of the music together. He wrote a great deal of music himself. And, you know, he did all the arranging and the orchestration. But, yeah, we work very, very closely. You know, sometimes the music comes first and then the poetry comes. Sometimes it's the other way around. But we come up with arrangements together. So it really is a collaboration.
Let me play something from the new CD that has music behind you, and I consider this poem to be one of like your greatest hits. You've you've also done a video of this poem that our listeners might have seen on MTV. This is called "Blink Your Eyes," and I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you're using the music behind you, how you work this out.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things going on in this particular version of it. One is that I wrote the poem really sort of, you know, responding to this well-documented and well-known antagonistic relationship between black and Latino males in particular and the police. So that was one part of it in terms of subject matter. The other part of it was, you know, I teach, and I started getting a number of students a few years back who were coming in to write poetry who were really influenced by hip-hop and really wanted to write in a way that was very different from what I knew and from the way I sort of came up or developed as a writer. And so they really, you know, I guess my reference point for a lot of people I came through with was jazz, people who wrote and tried to use jazz as a reference point. For them, it was hip-hop. So, you know, I tried to write this poem in sort of a dedication to them. Then the other part is a dedication to Sterling Brown, who was many people called the Dean of Black Poetry, and who wrote, I guess, particularly in a so-called folk idiom and in a blues idiom very much. Musically, I don't know. You know, we were sort of finding our way in the studio. We'd done this poem in a number of different ways, and we were really trying to find something fresh to make it sort of new and interesting to us. One of the things that happened is I made a sample and used a sample in this cut, and it's a sample of Sweet Honey in the Rock, singing group, singing a blues, Your Worries Ain't Like Mine, which I thought was fitting, given the subject matter of the piece. And then, of course, I thought it should have some sort of drive to it, some sort of driving pulse, some sort of driving beat. You know, so all of those ideas sort of came together to form what we have now.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is the poem Blink Your Eyes from Sekou Sundiata's new CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams.
I was on my way to see my woman, but the law said I was on my way through a red light, red light, red light. And if you saw my woman, you could understand I was just being a man. It wasn't about no light, it was about my ride. And if you saw my ride, you could dig that too, you dig? Huh? Do you really dig? Sunroof, stereo, radio, radio, sunroof, stereo, radio. Black leather bucket seats sit low. You know the body's cool, but the ties are worn. Ride when the hard times come, ride when they're gone. In other words, jet, the light was green. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes, blink your eyes. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you live in. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you live in. Up to the window come the law with his hand on his gun. What's up, what's happening? I said, I guess that's when I really broke the law. He said a routine, step out the car. He set a routine, assume the position. Hands up in the air, in on a routine, like you just don't care. License and registration. Deep was the night and the light did the deep in the deep was the night from the light from the north star on the car door. I could see deja vu, we've been through this before. Why did you stop me? Somebody, body, 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 body. Somebody had to stop you. I watched the news. You always lose. You're unreliable. That's undeniable. This is serious. You could be dangerous. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes, blink your eyes. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you're living in. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you're living in. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change.
People who are into rap really like rhyme. Do you think that that's made it safe to like poetry?
I think so. I think hip hop rap has really, if there's any single thing I could point to that has led the way and opened the doors for this current revival and this interest in poetry, I think that's been it. If for no other reason than it has prepared people to listen to the spoken word, and then again to the spoken word with music as well.
Now, what's your relationship to rhymes?
My relationship to rhyme.
I mean, do you like working with rhymes? You sometimes do.
Oh yeah, no question. I do. Although I don't set out to rhyme. You know, mm-hmm. I don't. You know, I write pretty much what's called open verse, not free verse, but open verse, where you know the poem really sort of dictates what the form is going to be. But yeah, no, I do like to rhyme. I think of it as a musical device. It's one of the ways I have learned to get to musicality in my writing. I mean, you know, there's certain techniques, rhyming, you know, repetition, use of song forms. I borrow a great deal from music and from particularly from popular music.
You know, there's a line in Harlem, A Letter Home, that I think so clearly shows the influence of song lyrics on your poems. When you're talking about being at the Apollo Theater and everybody wanting to be kissed the way they say. Why don't you do the line? Because I'm just paraphrasing.
We used to be backstage at the Apollo waiting for the stars, begging them to kiss us like they say. You know, it's a funny thing about that is, you know, I guess, you know, people project their own fantasies and dreams onto the lead singer in particular.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I always thought that, you know, that this must be the way they kiss, you know, the way they sing. It must be that beautiful, that compelling, you know.
And now you think?
I you know, it may be true.
Would you ever think when you're reading that people must project that onto you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a power spot, you know, to be in front of the band.
That's right.
To be the front man in a band and you got the microphone and the spotlight and, mm-hmm. you know, that is a mythic place, especially in American culture, you know. So I think, you know, it has probably less to do with me than the power of the position itself, you know.
Well, Seiko Sundiata, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to do it.
Seiko Sundiata has a new CD called The Blue Oneness of Dreams. It's on Mouth Almighty Records. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Terry Gross.
Yeah, baby. I mean, not like baby, baby, but just baby. You could say, I'm asking. But it's more like, I'm just trying to encourage you. Well now, the truth is, I'm begging. Some people say, love, unrequited love, makes good poetry. But listen, I'd rather have you. That's all the poetry I could ever dream of. So just tell me again, exactly why not? I'm just waiting for the wheel to turn. I got faith in you. I believe in you. Uh-huh. Yeah, baby. Yes, I do.
For much too long, I've been hiding this fire. But I don't.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.